Welcome to the Productivity Mastery Podcast, presented to you by myself, Stoyan Yankov, productivity and performance coach, keynote and TEDx speaker, and co-author of the Perform Methodology, and the book Perform, the Unsexy Truth About Startup Success. Join me on a journey to discover what some of the world's leading professionals do to be more productive, create peak performing teams, and build successful global companies. New episodes weekly. And now, enjoy today's episode. Welcome back to Productivity Mastery. My name is Stoyan, and I'm very happy to be welcoming yet another super exciting guest. I had a chance to meet Mark a couple of weeks ago during a private mastermind call, and I had so many questions. In fact, I probably have 792 questions I want to ask Mark, so let's see where we go. But my guest today is somebody that I admire for the work that he does. He's the author of a book called Leading from the Heart, and we will talk a lot about that, but he's not one of these woo-woo people that, you know, maybe you might be thinking, oh, leading from the heart, you know, he's probably somewhere up in the air. No, this guy has a lot of experience, 25 years of experience in the corporate world, leading organizations, being an executive in top companies, and he's now transforming organizations and leaders, helping people to recognize the importance of bringing the heart into the conversation. So I'm very excited to welcome Mark Crowley. How are you today, Mark?
I'm great. Thank you, Stoyan. I appreciate it. Lovely meeting you. You know, meeting with you all the way across the world here. It's like, I'm always amazed by technology. You know, you're in Bulgaria, I'm in California. We're having this conversation like we're sitting right next to each other.
It is amazing. Yeah, absolutely. Mark, I started listening to your book a couple of weeks ago. And immediately from the start, you started with this story of how you were growing up and what you were going through. Can you maybe, just for context of the audience, give us a bit of an idea about, you know, maybe the stories that you share in the book, and how was that in a way your, you know, personal journey turned into that, right?
I mean, it's a really big question because it really did, in retrospect, become sort of the inflection point in my life, which was a childhood that wasn't one that either one of us would want for our own children. But in retrospect, I have to be grateful for in this rather perverse way, because what happened was that my mother died when I was very young, and I realized that up until the point that she was still alive, but she was really insulating me from my father, who proved to be a deeply warped human being who psychologically and emotionally abused me through the rest of my childhood. And then when he had me in a pretty good crippled sense of esteem and self-belief, or a lack of, he kicked me out of the house with no money and no support. I never went back for a birthday or Christmas or any holiday. I saw him three or four times before he died 15 years later. But he pretty much set me up to fail in a very, you know, painful way, because it wasn't just that I wasn't confident in myself at the moment that he kicked me out, but I wasn't expecting it. So I had no resources, had no way of really taking care of myself. And I also had a challenge, which was, my father told me that I would never amount to anything. He fundamentally believed that I lacked. And so I equated graduating from college as this binary confirmation as to whether or not he was right or not. So I did have some people in my life saying, you know, you actually have more value than you're hearing at home, but his voice was the loudest. So I believed that if I didn't graduate from college, that I would be the abject failure that he always said I was, and that that would be the destruction of my life. So I was determined to graduate from college. And when I did, after trying to stabilize my life and make enough money to survive, get through all that, I did finally graduated from a very, very good school by the time it was all said and done. And I had a very good education. But it was in that moment that I started to talk to friends of mine who were going off to medical school or going off to law school and graduate school. And here I am just thinking, thank God I got through this. Like, you know, I don't even belong here. I don't deserve this. I'm still hearing my father's voice, even though I've just accomplished something remarkable. And I just started thinking, like, what's the difference between these people and me? Like, I don't believe I could possibly go to graduate school. And yet I'm graduating with the same grades from the same university. And I realized the difference was that they had somebody in their life who thoughtfully directed them, cared about them, and gave them safety and encouraged them and, you know, made love them, really, is what it came down to. So when I started managing people, and this is, I think, the pivot point that I'll never be able to explain, I made an unconscious decision to give people who ever worked for me, like anybody who worked for me, no matter what job they had, I was going to give them everything that I never got, tied to the belief that it was almost like an experiment in my mind. Like, I never got all this. And had I could have been infinitely more prepared for the world than I felt like I was when I was graduating. So I'm just going to give it to people. But I did this without knowing. I mean, I really wasn't conscious of it at all until I was 43 years old and a woman who had been working for me since the beginning of my career, 20 years, said to me one day, you know, you manage people very differently, don't you? And I said, well, what do you mean? And she started to describe the people that, you know, the people were working for in the same organization, and they were micromanagers and fear driven and, you know, always making people feel uncomfortable when they weren't hitting their numbers and so forth. And here I am growing people, developing people, making people feel safe, knowing that they had a leader who trusted them. You know, it's a very different world. So she's pointing all this out. And as I started hearing it, I like it all clicked. I'm like, oh my God, like it, this is what I did in response to. And so I never had any intention of being here with you today. I never had any intention of writing the book. What I wanted to do based on that feedback was perfect it. I wanted to become, I knew it was working. I'd already had 20 years of experience where I kept getting promoted and people kept thinking, this guy's a great leader. And I'm like, well, everybody manages this way, don't they? Like, it never dawned on me that I was doing anything unique. So as I started to refine it, I really learned there's a mastery to this, that if you aggregate certain behaviors and certain practices, that you're going to build extraordinary trust with people. They're going to be incredibly engaged. They're going to scale mountains for you. That's what I learned. So I kept getting promoted and had big challenges. So I wasn't like looking under the hood. I just was like, okay, I just want to just keep doing a great job of being a leader and doing a good job here. But the company that I was working for ended up failing and being bought. And it was being bought like it was like God on one side and the devil on the other side. It was like it was the worst culture possible. And it's a weird analogy, but you get the idea, the polarity of it. It was just the company that bought us was so toxic that I realized after 6 months, I can't stay here. So I decided I'm just going to leave. And so I negotiated, a little bit of a package to go. And then I thought, well, you know, I'm just going to write a book. And it wasn't until about a year later that I was knee deep in the process of writing the book that a friend of mine who was sort of following my progress said, you're going to have to explain why this worked. And it was in that process, and I'll stop here, where the research that I did ended up proving that like what I was doing with people was not just extraordinary, but that it aligns to human nature. It aligns to our biology, how we're hardwired. So we have been mismanaging people, thinking that we are rational beings when in fact we're not. And it has to do with feelings and emotions and the heart. So it was just this long journey that started from the day my father started raising me and abusing me is really what this came from. So
how did you shift the story, right? Everybody listening now, myself included, we all have our own stories and beliefs about who we are. And I wonder, did you what did you do to shift the story and to believe in yourself?
It was interesting. No one has ever asked me that question, by the way. And I've only been recently thinking about it. And there's two things that happened to me. And one, I just literally just like had the idea, like that had a big impact on me. So I'm going to share it. The first one was, there was a woman next door. She's, by the way, she's 94 years old. I talked to her and her family on Mother's Day just a few days ago. So she's still like integral in my life at 94 years old. But she lived next door and she had a sense. She wasn't explicitly understanding what was going on, but she had a pretty good sense that what was happening in my home wasn't a good environment. So she welcomed me in hers. So she already had five children, but every day I was over there and every day I was over there, she was laughing at my jokes and asking me what I was doing. And she gave me a sense that, wait a minute, like what I'm hearing over there isn't what everybody else sees. And I think I had a sense of myself that was more aligned to what she was seeing than what he was seeing. So that kind of was like, okay, well, maybe I'm right. You maybe it's not what he's telling me isn't accurate. But it was interesting. The same family, the oldest son, went on like a trip or something and asked me to deliver papers on his paper route. I don't know if they have that in Bulgaria, but you know, when I was a kid, you could actually have, you know, customers and deliver papers to their houses and so forth. And at 10 years old, I got my own paper route, which I had until I moved out to California 4.5 years later. So what this gave me was the opportunity to, you actually collect it. And that day, you actually, people would pay you money every week to get the papers. So you had to ring the doorbell, have a conversation with people. You're building trust and rapport. You're building relationship with these people. And I think this is the epiphany I'm just having in this moment, that day to day, that experience of interacting with a whole lot of people, I was getting a lot of validation that I was a pretty cool kid. So I went home and took the abuse, and I suffered from it. Trust me, it wasn't like, you know, a complete antidote, all these kind people. And then my dad, it was my dad heavily weighted in terms of, you know, beating down my self-esteem. But it was enough to give me a glimmer that I could be something different than what he told me.
And what would be your message to listeners who might have gone through similar experiences and had a rough childhood?
Well, you know, it's another fantastic question, because in my book, I talk about this. Her name is Mrs. Whitman. And so this is when I was a child, right? This is when I was a kid. And so when people come up to me when I speak in companies and conferences and so forth, people will come up to me, generally men. And so the first question that people ask me is, whatever happened to Mrs. Whitman? And I get to tell them that she's still in my life. But the men question is, they go, hey, can I talk to you for a second? And they go, I had what you had. My father was just like yours. And of course, none of our experiences are ever completely a blueprint. You know, everybody has the same exact one. But what people tell me constantly is that on some level, they didn't get the love and the support that they needed from one or two parents. And so there's a lot of this. So your question is really, really great. And without going into detail, what I will tell you is that I am not the only child in my family. I am the youngest in my family, and that the abuse that I suffered, they all suffered. And almost to a person, they took it so hard that they turned against themselves and effectively destroyed themselves, either through alcohol or, you know, an ascendance of a mental illness, because like they turned on themselves, like they couldn't turn on the switch that said, stop listening, stop carrying his voice. And so even to this day, I'll tell you, there are days where like something's going through my mind. We're going to talk about, you know, writing the book at the beginning and the resistance that I got and how that felt. And I would hear my dad's voice, like, you know, no one's ever going to buy this. No one's ever going to listen to this. His voice carries on. But you have to be able to work through that through, I did it through meditation. I did it. I actually had some help, you know, I had somebody, you know, actually guide me through this to heal it and to bring it to the surface, look at it, realize, like my father used to say that I was pusillanimous. And the word pusillanimous in English means effectively has a contemptible lack of ambition and drive, which was completely untrue of me. I am 10 years old with a full-on paper route every day, all that responsibility and doing that job maturely and school and all those kinds of things. There was nothing you could point to say Mark Crowley was pusillanimous. But in the process of writing the book and having help to kind of look at all of this, because it really was an interference, somebody said to me, you know, that's like ridiculous. Like that's laughable that somebody would call you pusillanimous. And I was like, oh, you're right. Like, you know, do you know what I mean? I mean, because I'm taking it to heart. I'm like, am I really that big of a failure, like, as a child? Like, am I really, I have no drive, no ambition. Like, I'm a loser like that. Like, that's where you're going through and you have to look at it and go, that's not truth. So put it aside and you have to do the work. It's work and it's painful. But if you don't do it, what I've seen, knowing that I'm the youngest and I don't feel like I'm betraying my family at all. All I'm really reflecting on is seeing how their lives have progressed and the harm. Let's just say they weren't successful lives because they could never get over the hump. They could never become, as author Anne Lamott says, militantly on your own side. You know, why would you be, you know, harming yourself and telling yourself anything that is bad about you on a daily basis? Like, just that whole practice is bad. But we learned it as children. In my family, we learned it as children. But if you continue it into your 20s and 30s, by the time you're 30 or 40, there's no escaping it. It's so hardwired into you that you're not going to recover. So take the painful action, look at it, and go through that stress. And it's distressing. You know, when you think about it, you just go, how did I, like, why did I have to go through all that? I wasn't a bad kid. But that's not the question. The question is, how do I recover from that so that I can thrive in my life? Because, like you sort of implied, everybody's got something. We've all had a difficulty, and you just have to man up or woman up and say, I'm going to take a good hard look at this, and I'm going to find out what's real and what's not real, and I'm going to go through the grief, and I'm going to forgive it. I actually had somebody say to me, who was almost a spiritual guide, she said, have you forgiven your father? This is when I'm writing the book the first time and I'm really struggling. And I'm thinking, I just can't even write a word down because my dad's voice was so loud. And she goes, have you forgiven your father? And I go, yeah, you know, of course I have. I've forgiven him. You know, it's been a long time now, 25 years. And she says, no, I mean, have you forgiven him? And I said, well, what do you mean? She goes, I mean, you go out in a forest and you start speaking to the sky and you tell him all the things that he did to you that hurt you. And then you have a little ceremony and you basically say, I'm forgiving you for all of it. Try that. Because you just have the sequence of this and this and this and this, and it's exhausting, but I did it. I know it might sound crazy to somebody, but the idea was to get it out of your system. It wasn't to talk to the gods. It was to get it out of you and to say, okay, I'm still standing. I'm going forward and I'm not letting you drag me down. So I'm forgiving you so that I can progress. And it's more about you than it is about the person that may or may not even hear the, you know, that you're forgiving them, knowing wherever they are in this universe of ours.
Mark, thank you so much for being so vulnerable and talking about these topics. You know, when you talk about this man come to you and share, they have similar stories and relating with you. A few years ago, my team and I organized a mastermind retreat in Bulgaria, which was primarily targeting business people. And we spent the week
in the country with a few speakers, coaches were leading the experience. I was more the organizer. And, you know, a group of, I think the first year was 12, 15 people, participants, then the speakers, the organizers. We all become a group and everybody's there to step up, to share, to be, to observe and get aware where they are. And then eventually, and every day was focused on one specific area of your life. But we set up those mastermind sessions where each person, even the speakers, they had to spend 1 hour on a so-called hot seat. Some people are aware about the concept of a hot seat. You share a challenge or a struggle, and then the other people in a small group of people, 3-4 people maybe around them, they're there to support the person, but also to tell them the truth from a place of care. And usually the first few minutes, people are bringing up a challenge, but it's not so something so deep, right? But when you have an hour, people really go deep because the other people are like, so we're saying that, but this and this is not really adding up. What do you mean by that? And then you get real. And to your point, you know, strong business people. I thought we're going to have conversations about sales and marketing and business development. It was all about my dad did this, my sister, my relationship, you know, and then you see the other person, I had a similar story. And everybody starts crying. Pretty much every person cried by the end of these 7 days. And for me, that was the eye-opener. Now that you share this story with me, it's like, we need to have more space to share and to get the support. As you said, sometimes it's difficult. These kind of processes, personal transformation processes, can take a while. So you might need to get a therapist or go to a special experience or whatever help you need to do. But, you know, the Tony Robbins had this kind of statement which resonated with me. I don't know if you've attended some of his experiences. I got to say, to me, to my personal journey, going to a Tony Robbins experience in my 20s was extremely transformative because I had a chance to see myself from a perspective and try to reinvent the story about who I believe I am. And he has this statement, the strongest force in the world is your need to stay consistent with who you believe you are. Something around these lines, right? Like if you believe you're not good enough, even if you do it for a while, you keep going back to your actions. The things that you do will be somehow aligned with who you believe you are.
I mean, obviously it completely confirms everything that we're talking about, right? So as an aside, I have a big Twitter following, and one of the like most consistent messages that I put out there regularly is know thyself. Because if you don't know who you are, you have no insight into what other people are going through. So you went through this event where you're bringing people in. I was going to ask you, did anybody leave by not crying? And that's a ridiculous, like, that's not the point of this. Like, so anybody that's like, oh, geez, that's not the point. The point is that people are living with some sort of pain, some sort of unforgiven or unpurified, you know, distress and grief that could come from a parent dying, or it could come from, you know, just something that happened in their life that they haven't resolved. But if you look into that and you understand what it was that caused you the grief, it leads you into an ability to have empathy for other people. And that's what people need. When you see that everybody in this meeting, you know, are out in the woods crying over something that's really painful for them, you're like, that's humanity. That's the human condition. But you can get over that. You know, if you bring those same people back and you said, let's tell the same story, they can tell it just like you and I are talking. And it's like there's no emotion because they healed it. And that's what people need to do. So get a coach. I've had the same coach for 12 years. And we talk about the same thing. Sometimes it's just you need to, like, you know that about you, right? You know that that's sort of your trigger. And I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. So don't go there, kind of a thing. But But, you know, sort of illustrate your story. Brian Tracy, I heard this like, you know, 30 years ago. He tells a story about a guy who he's a salesman. And he says, my goal is to make $100,000 this year. And so Tracy says, so you get to June, the end of June, middle of the year, and the guy's made $75,000. So he's like way ahead of his goal, right? Way ahead of his goal. And then Brian Tracy says, how much do you think that guy made at the end of the year? And you'd say, well, he made 150, because you would keep it going, right? And he goes, no, he made 100. And the reason he made 100 was because subconsciously he said, that's all I'm about. I'm a $100,000 guy. So, you know, Brian Tracy implies it as he starts to make fewer calls, he's working fewer hours, he's not, you know, he's not doing the very same things that he was doing. And it all starts here. But going back to the theme here, if you had somebody telling you that, you know, if you ever had a teacher that told you you weren't gonna, you're never gonna succeed, or a parent that ever had that in you, and that voice keeps going with you, if you don't mentally look at that and go, that's, I don't want that in my consciousness, like that doesn't belong here. It never belonged there, but it certainly doesn't. It's not going with me where I'm going. And if you can get that out of there, so that when that thought comes up and you know exactly where it is and know whose voice it is, this is what I was taught. Is that your voice or is that somebody else's voice? So when that mind is talking to you, is that you? Because would never talk to you that way. It's always going to be someone else's voice. And when you understand that, you just go, adios. You know, we're like, I'm not going to let that influence me any longer. This is a journey we're talking about. This isn't something that you can do in 25 minutes, you know, with some self-help tape. You know, you got to do the work, but it's worth it because you become more effective. You become more influential. You become who you're supposed to be, to your point.
And if I look at it from perspective, even though everybody goes through difficult times, in your case, you know, many difficult situations, the whole childhood, you know, all the suffering, all the pain. But if you think about it, it's also a blessing, because you wouldn't be where you are. You wouldn't have touched so many people. You wouldn't have been a leader from the heart to so many people while you were a manager, and then keep on impacting so many people and transferring this message, being here with us today. And you know, so in many ways it's a blessing, and it's not always the blessing, but also it's a blessing. And since we're talking about this, and I really want to hear more about, like, one thing that was for me, I want to say a surprise, but I just didn't know data, you know, because the book is called Lead from the Heart. When we talk about heart, we always think about this, you know, Valentine, red heart, right? And it's like, it's only for the people who are in yoga and, you know, Cupid, right, whatever, right? And then I read the book, and can you give us a bit of a perspective about the biological facts that we actually, heart is a lot more important when it comes to decision making.
So, yeah, I mean, that what we're about to talk about is the reason why it's called Lead from the Heart. It's not to be woo-woo or to be, you know, religiously oriented, spiritually oriented, although I do know there's a spiritual implication of everything that I'm talking about. I've learned that and discovered that. But what we're really talking about is the anatomical heart. But I want to tell you a little bit about synchronicities that happened to me in my journey. So my original plan was to write what became the second half of a book, which are the practices of leading from the heart. And the belief was that it would be a complete book, because if a manager did these four things together consistently, I proved they would have infinitely greater success as a leader. I proved it over and over, any age group, men, women, didn't matter what education. So I was convinced in this. And I mentioned this a minute ago, that I was ready to go, and I'd been thinking it through and organizing my piles, and I was getting ready to write. And a friend of mine called me one day, and sitting exactly where I am, he goes, you know, you're going to have to explain this to people. Otherwise, you know, people are going to think you needed a shitty childhood in order to lead this way. And Stan, I mean, I'm telling you, it was like instantly I knew he was completely right. And I had done none of the work. And I'm like, dude, like, he's right. Now I got to like go back and figure this out. I've got to explain why this works. So this was one of these other blessings, to use your word, because had he not done that, I wouldn't have addressed all the cynics who think the whole idea of this is ridiculous and preposterous and ineffective and a non-starter and all of that. So based on that conversation, I started thinking, okay, so what is it? What was I doing? Like, what was the effect on people so consistently that made them scale mountains for me and do such extraordinary work for me over and over through my career? And we're talking about 25 years of a career that went this way. So by the time I got up to the top, I'm managing thousands of people and people that were stockbrokers, people that only got paid if they sold something. So, you know, meat eaters, if you will. Kidding, but, you know, get the idea. And so I'm thinking about it, and I thought, I was affecting the hearts in people. Like, so deeply, like what I was doing was affecting people so deeply that they would do anything for me because of how it made them feel. Because I was supporting every deep human need that they had consistently. And to do that in a workplace was like very uncommon. And so people were like, I'll follow you anywhere. And I just took it. I wasn't seeing this. I just thought that's how people responded. And so it was much later that I
for the kind record, of put all the record. Pieces. Just for the record, what specific, can you give us some ideas about what would you do that you probably took for granted, but people really appreciate it?
I made people feel safe. So I never felt safe, right? So I never wanted somebody to go home on a Friday night and wonder if I, as their boss, you know, does he think I'm doing a good job? Am I doing a decent job? Am I going to get fired? So I always just made sure people knew exactly where they stood. And generally that was in good standing. So it wasn't just that, hey, you're doing a good job, Stoyan. I would literally say to them, I don't know how lucky I got when I found you, but like, you are such a great addition to this team. And I'm like, you mean the world to me in terms of what you've brought to our team and how you support me. And, you know, I'm just really grateful to you. And many managers will say, well, you know, you can't say that because the minute you do, tomorrow Stoyan comes into your office and goes, well, you know, you kind of told me I'm doing a great job. So I think I deserve a 10% raise and a bigger bonus and a better office. And that's not the way it works. People are so grateful just to hear, like, I've been working my ass off. So I appreciate knowing that. But most bosses don't tell people that. So they never know. So they're in their head, you know. And then they go home and they go, I don't think Mark likes me at all because he never tells me anything. And I'm working so hard. And the spouse goes, well, why don't you leave? You know, why don't you find something else if he doesn't appreciate you? And you're like, you're right. He doesn't appreciate me. And then you come into work and you're pissed off and you're bitter. And it's all a fabrication because I said nothing to you. This is how it works with people. Right. And it may not happen in an instant like that, but over a matter of time, Mark never says anything to me. He doesn't know. He doesn't let me know where I am. I'm making such a huge contribution here. And I'm going to go. I'm going to leave. And so this is how human nature works. Right. So that's an example. So in any event, what ends up happening is that I reached out to a world-class cardiologist and wrote her a letter and said, I have this theory that I was affecting the hearts of people. And what I would like to know is whether there's any science to support it. So here's the interesting thing about her. Her mother died of a heart attack. Her father died of a heart attack. And she became, I think, she kind of admitted it. She went and became a cardio surgeon almost to unconsciously heal her parents and to heal herself for the loss, because they were both dead before they were 50. And so I walked into her office, and she knew my thesis, and I walked into her office. She didn't even get out of her chair. And she looked up at me and she goes, Mr. Crowley, you have figured out something. We've just figured out ourselves. We're just discovering ourselves in medicine. She said, when I went to medical school, I was taught that the heart is a carburetor. Think of it like a car part. You know, there's no humanity there. There's nothing important. It's just a pump. So she said, we all took the professors who were also doctors, you know, at their word. And she said, then I started treating patients and people were coming in with serious heart problems. And I'd say, well, tell me about your life. And they go, well, I'm in a bad marriage, or I've got a really stressful job, or I drink too much, or I'm having really financial, very difficult financial situations. And she starts to see, she's like, wait a minute. Like, all the people that have heart problems weren't because they were born that way. Most of the people that she was treating had heart problems because of their biography. And she said, if your biography affects your biology, that can't be a car part. That heart is responding to what's going on in someone's life. So she said, this light bulb went off inside of me when I just realized that I was taught incorrectly. We cannot treat the heart as if it's just a pump. So she started doing her own research, and she introduced me to an organization that's been researching the science of the heart and the heart's intelligence for the last 30 years, all because she was so enthusiastic about what I was telling her I had discovered on my own. And through that process, learned the science that shows that the heart and the mind are connected, that the heart sends more signals to the mind than the other way around, that we're not rational beings at all, that up to 95% of our behavior is being driven by our feelings and emotions. So if that's the case, we shouldn't be appealing to the heads, the minds, and people. We need to be appealing here. We need to be thinking about what are the feelings and emotions that create good feelings inside of people, the positive emotions that we know that human beings are not only hardwired to thrive on, but that lead to when they experience them frequently, which is what they told me I was doing. They said, basically what you did was people were marinating in positive emotions. So you're setting up for the whole team for optimal performance. It's no wonder you got such extraordinary performance. So like you said, it's not this, it's the anatomical heart. And I don't know if you can see the cover of my book through on your screen, but it intentionally has the anatomical heart on it so that people do not, right in the middle, that's the anatomical heart that you do not construe as anything other than science, biology, human nature.
Thanks so much, Mark, for sharing. You published the book, was it 12 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
12 years ago. I wonder, what was the response? I mean, seems like the business world is a lot more open to these type of topics these days, but what was the response 12 years ago when you enter a conversation with an executive or a business team? How did your message get accepted?
So I think, you know, we have at least, we sort of have to kind of assess that our standard traditional leadership theory was born in the Industrial Revolution. You know, so basically what we believed at the time was pay people as little as possible, squeeze as much out of them as possible, and replace them if they don't do good work. Right. So I, look, man, here's the deal. I'm going to pay you. I'll give you a little extra if you produce more than you're supposed to. But if you don't do a good job, I got somebody sitting in the other room ready to take your job. So it's fear, intimidation, and taking advantage of you. That was traditional leadership theory. So I come along and say, oh, no, you need to start caring about your people, and you need your leaders to be right. It's start there. Right. The just instantly, it's like, this guy's completely full of shit and he doesn't get business, doesn't understand. And so it was instinctive because we've just passed on traditional leadership theory for so many generations that they just hear the word heart and they're like, no, man, you don't do that. Like, that backfires on you. People will take advantage of you. You need to be, you know, where are you on this? And if you don't hit your numbers this month, think something bad could happen. That's kind of the attitude that we have. So people hear the word heart and they're like, that guy doesn't understand where we're at. He doesn't get the real world. And nobody ever asked in these instinctive decisions, like, what's your background? Have you ever tried this? Do you have any evidence that this works? So what was so interesting about that conversation that I had with my friend that day, when he said, you know, you're going to have to explain why. I didn't just explain why the heart is a big deal. I explained that engagement is at record lows, that job satisfaction's at record lows, and now we've got 100 million people quitting jobs in America. And you're like, that's not normal. People don't normally quit jobs. They only quit jobs if they're unhappy in them. Like, for so we should be looking at ourselves and our leadership, but we just built it into the equation. We just said, you know, we get 25%. We shouldn't lose 25% of our people every year, but let's just beef up our recruiting, beef up our training, and we'll just keep it going. So people still don't matter. And I think that it's only because of COVID that I have, you know, I did predict in the original book that a day was coming and that people were going to rise up and say, I'm not going to work for any organization that doesn't value me, doesn't care about me, support me, and offer a win-win beyond just a paycheck. What I couldn't have predicted was what was going to motivate that. I just thought the tipping point would occur, but COVID was what did it. Because you had people all over the world with plenty of time to think about, am I happy with my job? Am I happy with my boss? Am I happy with my organization? And all of the world was like, no, no, no. And so people were like, life is too short. We have all these people dying because of COVID, and we didn't know if this was ever going to end. And now that I have my life back, I have different values. So companies are looking at this. They still have the squeamishness. I would be lying to you if I thought, you know, I'm like, they're throwing me a parade now and saying, oh, you were right. That's not where we're at yet. We're still at the, you know, you see it with the layoffs via email and the how companies have just dismissed people. There's no heart in that. But there's a consequence for that. You know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And every time companies treat people badly, it's more resistance. It's more people saying, I don't want to live like that. I don't want to work for anybody like that. So the companies that are figuring this out and the ones that are saying we need to demonstrate to people that they have a manager, if whoever they work for in this company is somebody who's their advocate, their coach, their supporter, those are the companies that are going to thrive. And the ones that continue to use traditional leadership theory, they're not going to attract talented people, because talented people have had the same epiphany, which is, life is too short to put up with that.
You know, Mark, I did a TEDx talk last year, and the title of it, thank you. The title of it was Why Caring for People is Good for Your Business Too. And I was doing research so I can provide some data, because I believe in what you believe in, but people like numbers, right? And I found this study from 2017, which showed that some of the largest tech companies in the world, you know, Meta, Alphabet or Google, Oracle, you name it, they only managed to retain their people between 1 and 2 years on average. Different time frames, but between 1 and 2 years. And I started digging into, you know, why are these people quitting, right? They get provided great salaries, benefits, you name perks. It, right? Perks, healthcare. And then when they quit, they fill in the survey, right? And the main reasons you can see were, my manager didn't care. I did not feel appreciated. I wasn't having clear priorities. Manager took all the credit from what I do. I wasn't given the things that I enjoyed doing. Like all reasons that they're not connected to the paycheck. Because obviously these organizations can offer that already, right? And I was thinking about that, and really what you're saying very much resonates with me. But then again, there will be many people listening right now, and they'll be like, you know, that care thing is great, right? Leading from the heart, amazing, but we need to get things done. And maybe here's the time to mention, I love what you said in the book. We are already leading from the brain. Numbers are important. Productivity is important. Results are important. That's why we build businesses. It's not, hey, let's just lead from the heart, have fun, and go home. No. that's not what we're talking about. The problem is that we're maybe too much focused on the one side, and we need to balance out
Talk to me about that.
You know, if I could do it all over, I might have called the book Lead from the Mind and Heart, because that would might telegraph a little bit more of what I'm talking about. But so you're absolutely right. I mean, so we're not saying take the mind out and just, you know, hug people and sing kumbaya all the time. That's not what this is about. What this is about is saying that, and you hinted at it a second ago, you know, work forever. People went to work to meet their basic needs, food, shelter, right? Basically, to be able to provide for their own needs and the needs of their family. And so a paycheck was the exchange, the value exchange. And that was acceptable to most people because they were like, hey, man, I'm not thinking about, you know, self-actualization or, you know, my need for growth or anything. I'm like, I need a paycheck in order to live. But as that's become easier for people, people start to look at their lives. And Maslow was the one who kind of, you know, really kind of formulated this whole structure around this and saying that we have needs that progress and that the needs progress into more social skills, more, you know, emotional, psychological benefits, and truly like making a difference, like leaving a mark, and self-actualization is kind of what he called it. So the implication is that people are looking at work and they're seeing paycheck is no longer enough for me. Like you cannot expect me to just come to this place and be here for 10 days unless I'm getting an opportunity to grow, unless I'm getting coaching, unless I feel safe working here, you know, with diversity and psychological, emotional safety. People want to be able to be themselves and not be criticized for their ideas and values. I mean, these are things that probably people have always wanted to have, but weren't willing to negotiate because the job and paycheck was so important to them. So the way that I've described this, if you went up to people and said, you work for Mark Crowley, what's one word you would use to describe him? Well, you'd say, oh, he's the heart guy. Like everybody knows that's who he is. He's the heart guy. And they go, well, not when I work for him. And you go, what? You go, well, he was the heart guy, but he was also the most demanding guy I ever worked for. And you'd say, well, why was he so demanding? Well, it was because I felt like I'm supporting these people in so many meaningful ways, like Maslow's foundation, if you will, that people had those needs met so securely that I'd say, well, do you want to just like do average work or do we want to do something extraordinary here? Like, let's do something really great. And so if the company wants us to achieve this, let's us do this. Now, you have to align rewards to do this. Otherwise, it becomes rather self-serving, right? We're all going to scale the mountain, but I'm only going to be the one that gets named as the top of Mount Everest, right? I had 20 people help me, but you'll never hear about those people. That's not a fair deal. The fair deal is that those people have to get, they have to have rewards. So if you go from here to here, there's incremental rewards. And as long as that's in place, then I just set higher expectations because we could, because the team was so, there was collaboration. People were sharing best practices. They'd come into meetings and they'd applaud each other for doing great work. They felt so great being part of a team. It wasn't a whole team of all-stars. It was a team of contributors that wanted to do something extraordinary as a group. And I proved this over and over and over. Every business that I ever managed, it was the same thing. And if you look in sports today, if you look at the coaches that are winning, that are the ones that we look at universally in America and outside in football, soccer, basketball, you name it, they all care about their people in an extraordinary way. Every single one of them. There's just no common denominator better than the fact that those players feel like their manager loves them, cares about them, wants the best for them, and also wants to integrate them and unite them in a team. And why wouldn't we want to bring that to business? That's what I'm saying, right? We love it when our coaches are hugging their players, and I'm not really talking about hugging, but the hug is the demonstration that the coach feels something for their people. Why wouldn't we want that in business? That's what our, that's what we all want as human beings. That's what we want to work for. So why are we so resistant to giving it to people? That's the big hurdle, which I simply don't understand, because we're still there. You know, like, I have kept my paper route to supplement my income. I haven't really, but, you know, I'm kidding. But, you know, it's like, this is still a struggle in business because of the old ways of thinking that we haven't overcome yet.
So there's maybe many ambitious professionals watching and listening to the podcast. Some of them may be employees, some of them mid-managers, some of them executives or startup founders. What would be your message to the people who are not necessarily the so-called people person, right? There's many of these people that are really good in structure, operationally, technically, but maybe the people side doesn't come so natural to them. How could they become more caring leaders?
You know, when I first started in my career, one of the, I think one of the strategies, now that you know my story, one of my strategies for success was to behave in a way that would influence people to like me. And so I was friendly and humorous, and it worked. You know, everywhere I went, people liked me. So but it became my orientation. So it became my psychology. So when I got into work and I identified that, one of the skills that I didn't have was being direct with people. Because if I said, hey, Stoyan, you know, you've come into work 3 days late now, I need you to get here on time. That whole expression, the way I just said it to you, was very difficult for me, because I'm thinking, if I say that to him, he's not going to like me. So, you know, you're 23, 24 years old. This is, and given my upbringing, this was sort of, you know, something that carried, came with it. So I'm in a deficient position to be a good leader if I can't say to people, hey, I need you to get here on time, right? Simple as that. So I hired somebody who had that skill to be my chief of staff. I hired somebody, and she used to come into my office, and her name was Barbara, and she used to leave me these notes. I will be direct with Barbara every time I speak with her. So she was like coaching me to become more direct with her. But what I needed, because I'm building something, and I, you know, building something new at this point in my career, and I wanted people to buy in. So I just figured I'm going to offset it until I cultivate the skill. So Elon Musk is one, the greatest genius of our time. It's irrefutable what he's been. Anybody that can send a rocket into space and have it land where it started is a genius. He's not a good leader from a people standpoint, right? So he would be smart, like he did at Twitter, to hire somebody who is. He can still be the figurehead. He can still be the owner. But hiring somebody that knows how to do this would be the first step. So if you're starting up, pick your second number two person and let them do it. Because I do think it's in everyone, but I also say, and I believe this, that if you fundamentally don't enjoy seeing other people thrive and succeed and grow and contribute, if you feel it really should be all about you, then you shouldn't be a people leader. Go do an individual contributor job, whatever that is. But the reason is because, and you hinted at this earlier in your TED talk, that one of the biggest complaints that people have about their boss is that they feel the boss actually competes with them. And the reason they compete with them, and this goes back to the know thyself thing, is that they don't believe enough in themselves. So if I start to teach you what I know, I cultivated these skills, and I'm going to teach Stoyan these skills, what's going to happen? He's going to want my job. He's going to go to my boss and say, I know this as well as he does, and I'm smarter than he is, and so you should be giving me. So I'm going to go, nope, I'm not teaching you a damn thing. It took me 5 years to learn it. You go learn it yourself. But I'm 24 years old, and I'm managing this team. That wasn't my thinking. My thinking was, the more I can accelerate their growth, the more that I can teach them what I know, the faster they're going to be able to contribute, and better they contribute, the better reflection on me as a leader. And that's what people saw. And so I never really thought about, are they gunning for me? Are they trying? So you have to be secure in yourself to do this. because the minute you can look and see and say, those people are not a threat to me. This is my team, and my responsibility is to help them grow. My responsibility is to make them feel like they're contributing here and to develop their skills and to appreciate them and make them feel safe and valued and all the things that I've talked about. That's your responsibility. And if you can't do that, if that doesn't feel good to you, Gallup has figured out, I call this a caring gene, but they've mathematically figured out that just 1/3 of the world's population has the orientation I'm talking about, naturally. So you make them a manager, you make 100 people a manager, 33 of them by natural distribution are going to have the inclination to care about other people. That's not to say that they can't learn it. These 33% come into the world with that orientation, right? So it's interesting because what is the level of engagement in America in workplaces? It's about 33%. So without choosing people who really care about people, the number of people that are happy in their jobs is a reflection of the natural distribution of humanity. So organizations need to start hiring people and they need to be able to, I'll give you a great question. So I say to you, so this is an interview question that will give you an indication of whether or not they should be a manager working in your organization. So you say, well, you know, so have you ever, go along with me. Have you ever like helped somebody that worked for you to become more, maybe to progress in their career, get a promotion? Have you ever done that?
I believe so, yes.
Do me a favor. And so you've said yes. So now do me a favor and give me the names of 2 or 3 people that you did this for, and then tell me specifically what you did to help them get that promotion. That's when they go, well, you know, I helped Tom, you know, I told Tom he was great. And, you know, I'm like, no, but what did you do? Did you teach him anything? And they don't have the story to tell because they have never done it. And I've hired people into management roles that did this with people they worked with. They just like, I'll help you. Come on over here. I'll show you how to do this. Like that's their orientation. We could transform the world if we just made this one shift in hiring. I truly believe that. I mean, it would be magical. Now, going back to your other question, you still have to have the ability to go, Stoyan, you need to be here on time. And Stoyan, you're not hitting your numbers. You know, you still have to have that ability to have that conversation. But my experience is that when people feel like they can trust you, that you have their best interest at heart, that you truly invest in them, that you care about them. When you come in and you go, hey, Stoyan, you've been late a couple of days in a row and I really need you to, I already know, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do it again. It's like over in an instant. It's like, you don't want to disappoint me because you already know, like, this is too good to blow, you know? And so the relationship just keeps going very, very smoothly. I'm not going to worry about you not being on time again because I know you're going to correct it. And it's just this quick conversation as opposed to something like this that happens when people don't feel cared about. And so I come to you and I go, hey, Stoyan, you know, you've been late 2-3 days in a row. And you're like, yeah, well, you know, did you know my wife is sick? No, because you never asked, you know, do you know why I'm coming? Right. It's all of that, you know, and it's like, yeah, I'm 3 days late. But did you see that I'm meeting all of my expectations and you've never said anything? It's like all of that's going on inside of people.
I strongly believe in that, man. I love that you explain it so well. Leading from the heart also means you show up and you're the person that needs to set clear expectations about the priorities, about the role of the person in the team, providing feedback. And feedback, as you said, I'm sure you've seen some of these studies as well. It's not only positive feedback that people like. People want to know everything. People are more engaged and happy when they receive constructive feedback as well, even if there is nothing positive in them, right? But they want to know how they're doing. I lived in the Nordic countries. I lived in Denmark for 10 years. And the culture in Denmark is, you know, people, they are not very talkative. And I worked, the least to say, right? But I worked, I had a part-time job. And my manager, I would be like, you know, after a few days, I don't receive any feedback, right? And I'm like, hey, how am I doing? And the answer was, if I don't say anything,
then it's fine. It's like, that's not what I want to hear, you know?
Correct.
Like,
that's nobody not, that's does. Not how... Right.
But that's kind of a, it's like a lot of, I don't know. I think we need to definitely, I'm so happy that there's people like you that are spreading this message, that are working closely with leaders. And I do believe we're going to live in a much better world if everybody takes this message to heart and start thinking of how can I lead? How can I care for others? How can I make sure that everybody's well taken care of? They have everything they need. There was another guy on the podcast, a former Apple executive. He mentioned, I work for my people. People don't work for me. Like that, my mindset when I go to work is I work for my people. I need to make sure I'm there for them no matter what.
You know what? I have a problem with that, believe it or not, even though I'm like the biggest advocate for this, right? So, and the reason that I have a problem with it is that the company is paying him to do a job. So you can't lose sight of the fact that you wouldn't be there taking care of your people if it wasn't for the fact that your company hired you to do that job. So you have to balance them both, right? You, in other words, if I think a more mature response to this or a way of thinking about this is that the company is hiring you and rewarding you for getting certain work done. And your decision is, how am I going to do that? Am I going to do it with whips and chains and fear and intimidation and micromanagement? Or am I going to do it along the lines of what I'm prescribing, right? So I make the decision that I'm going to care about my people. I want that to be noble. I want that to be because you care about other human beings and you want other people to do well. But I also am a realist. And so what I'm saying is that that's the best way to get the job done. It happens to be the best way to get the job done. So when I hear some manager say, you know, I'm here to serve my people, it's like, no, you're not. You're choosing to serve your people as a means to getting what work needs to be done. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing duplicitous about that. It's actually a really joyful thing because you're enjoying being with the people that you're doing the work with, and you're not in competition. There's no power struggle. People enjoy coming to work. But at the same time, you're still, you know, put it this way. If the manager that you're talking about, any manager that says, I'm here to serve my people, if they don't get the results, the company doesn't go, well, you're doing a great job of serving your people, but you're not hitting your goals. But so we'll keep you around just to serve your people. That's not going to happen. So I have to appeal to where most people are in their consciousness, which is to say, this is the way you get better job done. This is the way you get results better than you were getting before. So whatever you're doing right now, if you're the star of your team, you'll be a bigger star by doing this. So it's, you know, I'm sorry. I just, when I hear that, I just think now we're taking it too far, you know, and then that's when people resist what I'm saying in the first place. And so that's why I'm saying this.
No, I love it. I love it. It's like the team synology, right? We want to win.
Yes.
Our goal is to win.
Correct.
And if you were to do the right thing, you care for people, first of all, that's effective for us to produce the result. But then as a bonus, it's the right thing to do. You make people feel good, but that's more of a, you know, it's not the main goal. The main goal is clear. So thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you. For being with us.
I definitely would love to have you once again at some point, because there are so many questions I wanted to ask. For everybody listening, I just want to remind you guys, for those of you who are watching the video, that's the name of the book, Lead from the Heart by Mark Crowley. You can find it in any kind of format. I chose the audio book and I really love it because it's with the voice of Mark. So I can listen to him even if he's not nearby. So this is fantastic. Thank you so much, Mark. Thanks everybody for listening. And once again, if you enjoyed this episode, share it with a friend. Make sure to subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts and enjoy your day. Hopefully you get some inspiration. Hopefully we inspired at least one person to decide, you know what, I'm going to wake up tomorrow and I'm going to put on the leading from the heart hat and I'm going to transform the way I manage people forward. Thank you so much and see you once again the next episode of Productivity Mastery. Ciao.
Thank you guys for listening. Make sure to subscribe to my monthly newsletter by visiting stoyanyankov.com and also learn about the Perform methodology and the Perform book, as well as our various personal and team coaching offers. Stay tuned and keep performing.